powerful is the Cox Network. So powerful that one day, the internet will let your doctor perform miracles from thousands of miles away.
Connecting to remote operating room.
Giving a whole new meaning to the term house call.
Operation complete.
The Cox Network. With gig speeds everywhere, it's internet built for tomorrow, today. Cox, bringing us closer. In Cox serviceable areas, speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms apply. Other restrictions may apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Thank you. And welcome back to Prague Watch once again, my faithful friends out there in Prague land. And that first tune was Astrology Prelude by Eric Norlander from his Echoes from the Collective album in 2012. And Eric is the subject of our program today. I caught up with him a few weeks ago via Skype, and I'll let you hear some of that interview right now. I wanted to ask you, were you like a child prodigy? You know, were you playing, you know, Chopin when you were three, you know, on the keyboard?
Well, let's see. I was probably playing like the easiest Beethoven pieces when I was eight. So it's not quite as impressive as.
Well,
as
no, no, I was exaggerating. That's still right. Incredibly impressive. Please. You know, I started
when I was 8 years old, like a lot of kids do. You just, you know, play your Hannon exercises and you learn Fur Elise and all the, you know, classical things that, you know, you're supposed to learn. And I definitely wasn't a prodigy. I mean, you want to talk about, you know, someone like Jordan Rudess or someone, okay, that guy's a prodigy. You know, that guy, as long as I've known him, he's just a ridiculous, you know, amazing, can play anything backwards and forwards, upside down. I started when I was a kid, took lessons for a lot of years. I played in, you know, in the various bands in junior high and high school, jazz band, concert band. I think in my junior and senior year of high school, I played piano in the jazz band, clarinet in the marching band. No, wait, saxophone in the marching band and clarinet in the concert band. I think I ended up having three periods of music somehow. I passed some AP tests or something that got me out of some classes. And I think I did a summer school thing. So anyway,
cool.
I did that a lot. And then of course I continued studying in college. And when I was 16, I got my first synthesizer, this crappy little Roland string synth. And in fact, I've got it packed up now, but I could have pulled it out and showed it to you. But anyway, that was, I started playing that, you know, and my first rock bands, and, you know, we do little gigs and I make a little money, and I had my after school fast food job and just save up a little money. And, you know, I remember buying a Rhodes 88, you know, which were not especially like in the early 80s, those were definitely not in fashion. So you could get like this beautiful Rhodes piano for, you know, a few hundred dollars where,
but that was a lot of money then.
Yeah, it was a lot of money, but yeah. I mean, you know, now if you want to buy a real nice Rhodes, it's a couple thousand dollars.
Right.
I just work really hard and try to develop a style, because that's really what it's all about. You know, you think of, you know, the greatest artists, no matter whether it's a keyboard player, a guitar player, a painter, or an actor, and what you appreciate most about them is not necessarily their technique, but their style. You know, like everyone talks about, you know, you want to hear David Gilmour just play real slow notes with beautiful vibrato and all that. And that's kind of what it's all about. And I know there's an expression, I forget who came up with it, but it is, what is it? I have to get it right. Style is not about what you can do. It's about what you can't do. If everyone could play keyboards like Franz Liszt, you know, then everyone would play super fast all the time and do these amazing scales and, you know, left hand or the right hand and back again. But maybe if you're, you know, Chick Corea, you don't want to play like that. You want to come up with like these cool scales and like get inside certain modes and that sort of thing. And if you're Keith Emerson, you want to like do these kind of cool fourths and fifths ascending lines and that kind of thing. If you're Rick Wright, you know, you want to just kind of groove on major seven chords and like do these nice kind of slightly jazz influenced kind of blues progressions. You know, if you're Tony Banks, you know, Hammond Mellotron textures and really nice constructed lines. Mm-hmm. You know, I could go on, but yeah. You get the idea.
Yeah, it'd be boring if everybody was the same. But yeah, it is about what people do in their own, you know, and play to their strengths and their interests. And yeah, it's what makes it interesting.
I grew into an adult, let's say, in the 80s. I graduated high school in 1985. And around that time, Eddie Van Halen was just kind of the king of the world. And every guitar player I played with wanted to be Eddie Van Halen. And they all had these like crappy Kramer guitars, whatever they were, with the bars, and they'd make their horsey sounds on the guitar. You know, Eddie Van Halen is an awesome guitar player. Let's be clear about that. But everyone was trying to play like Eddie Van Halen. And it's like, God, can you please stop? Can you just play like a nice melodic solo? Can you play like a rhythm part without doing like the squealing artificial harmonic thing? That goes to what we're talking about. It's like, you know, develop some style of your own. And obviously there are guys in the 80s that did develop, you know, styles of their own. But man, I remember that, like every guitar player I worked with, like, does anybody play a Les Paul anymore? Does anyone play an ES-335 or, God forbid, an acoustic guitar? So anyway,
yeah,
I'm off on some wild tangent, but there you go.
Yeah, I like going off on tangents. It's like, you were talking about the 80s and people, you know, having a style. I'm not the hugest U2 fan in the world. I mean, but back then they were huge. And the Edge is definitely a guy who, you know, doesn't have a heck of a lot of technique, really. But what he does, it's interesting. And he's like just owned it. He just made it his own. You know, the way he plays is nobody else plays like that.
You're right. And, you know, you think about the Edge and you think about the way he used echoes and effects and, you know, kind of coming up with those real specific kind of riffy things that he did when combined with the echoes, you know, really became the sound of that band.
Right.
And once again, there you go. It's like style is all about what you can't do. And, you know, the Edge couldn't play like Yngwie Malmsteen.
Right.
He couldn't play like Al Di Meola, but he could play like the Edge. And man, you know, that guy, I'm not a huge U2 fan, but I appreciate them. And I totally get what the guy's about. And, you know, I certainly look up to everything that he's done.
And speaking of style, I figured I'd break up the interview a little bit. So right now I'd like to play a song that'll get you a little more into Eric's style. The name of the song is On the Wings of Ghosts. It's from his solo album Into the Sunset from 2000.
Thank you.
And once again, the name of the song was On the Wings of Ghosts by Eric Norlander from his solo album Into the Sunset, the year 2000. I'm going to let you hear a little more of that interview.
Do you want to elaborate a little on like how did you get together with Mark McCright and form the Rocket Scientists?
Okay, well, let's see. Mark McCright sat next to me in Mr. Costley's European history class.
Really?
In high school, circa 1983, I'm going to say, somewhere around there. He was a year older than me. He still is a year older than me, in fact. And he had moved to Los Angeles from Atlanta. His dad had moved to LA for new big job there, and so Mark came in his senior year. So we're just ended up talking about music, like kids do, and we found that we had a lot in common. We both really liked Yes, and we both really liked Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and King Crimson, and the Moody Blues, and Jethro Tull, and all that kind of stuff. A Rush back then, of course, too.
Yeah.
So we just kind of struck up a friendship, and I found out he played guitar and he sang, and so we'd get together and record little things. We'd record covers of various songs we liked. I had a band in high school, and Mark actually mixed sound for us at a few gigs we did, and then for whatever reason the guitar player left, and then Mark joined the band, and we just kind of built it from there. And Rocket Scientists officially started probably around, let's say around 1988, I think. I should mention, after high school, we both went to UCLA together to college, and we were actually roommates for the first year, wow. Which would have been 86, I guess. So, we still kind of did our own thing, but we played together when we could. And then, probably like 88, 89, we started Rocket Scientists. And we actually had a lead singer in the band, a guy named Scott Jones, who now is in a band called Heliopolis.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm familiar with them.
Yeah, Scott, we did what we could to build something. And, he had this kind of high, like, John Anderson, Geddy Lee, Rick Emmett kind of voice. And, we did some really good stuff. We did some great shows. And I think in the end, we had some disagreements over the writing and direction and, which way we wanted to take the band. And so Scott ultimately left, but we stayed friends. And in fact, both Scott and Mark were groomsmen in my wedding in 1990.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And, let's see, when my wife Lana did her first big Japanese tour in 1998, Scott was working at a mastering company in Tokyo, Bernie Grundman Mastering, which is based in Los Angeles, but they had a mastering studio in Tokyo. And I guess he had a chance to go over there and, work there for a while, which is pretty cool. So when we did Lana's first big concert in Tokyo with like 2,000 people or something like that, Scott came to the gig. So it was great. It's fun to stay in touch with people, and you kind of keep track of each other as you grow. I even did a gig here in San Francisco just like a year or two ago. My friend Kurt Mattson put on a little festival, and he called it NorCal Prog Fest. That was it. And so I played with my solo band, and Heliopolis with Scott also played. So we got to hang out a little bit then. And so anyway, once again, I'm off on a tangent, but Mark and I, we put together the first album, Earthbound, in the early 90s. And we started with a drummer named Tim Garrett, who was in a band called Streets, which was kind of a Kansas spinoff. It was Steve Walsh was the singer and the keyboard player, and Billy Greer was the bass player, and Tim was the drummer.
Wow.
And a guy named Mike Slamer was the guitar player. And Mike came from an English band called City Boy.
I know some city boy. Yeah.
Yeah. And Mike's a producer now, and he's a great guitar player. Anyway, so we, once again, you know, we did some shows and so forth, and Tim ended up leaving the band, and I think he actually left in the middle of, I remember exactly, it was the song Earthbound. He was recording it, and he was just kind of going through some personal stuff. He was getting divorced, and he just couldn't focus. And he got up, like, he did a take, and he's like, I got to go. And he left.
And that was it.
We're like, well, we have the studio booked for, you know, the rest of the day. What are we going to do? So I've been playing in some other projects and doing some sessions with this drummer named Tommy Amato. And so I gave Tommy a call and I said, hey, what are you doing right now? He was watching a movie or something, and he lived just a couple miles away. I said, hey, come down to the studio. I need you to play on something. So he sat down on Tim's kit, which was all mic'd up, and he ended up playing Earthbound. And that's what's on the record.
Wow. That's a cool story.
Yeah. And, then we brought in a couple of different bass players. Mark and I both play bass, but we wanted like a bass player, you know, like a real bass player. So we had a few guys play on songs, and my friend Don Schiff was a great bass player.
Don's great. He's awesome.
Yeah. And he also played Chapman Stick, which, you know, when you're trying to do something in the prog world, Chapman Stick, come on, man, that's right. Dead center.
Sure.
So I asked Don, I said, hey, would you come in and, you know, just play on some of this stuff and let's just see how it goes. And so he came in, and I think Earthbound may have been the first song he played on too. And he did it on stick. And once we heard him play in our music, we're like, okay, that's it. Everyone else is fired. Like we're going to replace all the other tracks. And we did. And so Don ended up playing on that whole first record, basically as a session. Then when it came time to do the second record, Brutal Architecture, we just asked Don and Tommy to do the whole thing. It's like, well, that was what was great about the first record, that, you know, that's, those guys really brought a lot of personality to it. And so the four of us just, you know, spent some weeks in a room and just kind of woodshedded arrangements and all of that. And that was the second album. And then we actually did a tour after that. We were invited to do a European tour. We played at a couple of festivals, and including the Rotherham Rocks Festival in Yorkshire, England. This would have been 1997, actually. We also played at a festival, the German Progressive Rock Festival in Bruxelles, Germany, where we opened up for Asia, and actually met John Payne there. And then, of course, 10 years later, we'd end up working together. But yeah, we did that tour, and we put out a live album. And then we started working on the third album, Oblivion Days. But around that time, Lana, her career just skyrocketed. We had a label in Japan that just really believed in her. And they had a record store and a magazine and, you know, kind of the whole infrastructure. And they released her first two albums. And like the first one sold 3,000 and the second one sold 4,000. And then they said, okay, well, for the third one, we're going to create a whole new label. We're going to be distributed by, I think it was JVC or some major company, and we're going to do major promotion and all that. So we put out her third album, Garden of the Moon, on their new label, which was called Avalon, which was named after the song Mark and I had written on the first Rocket Scientist album, actually. And that album sold 40,000.
Wow.
So it went from like 3,000 to 4,000 to 40,000 in Japan.
Wow.
And so that was a big deal. And so we went over there for several tours. And it was kind of like nonstop Lana Lane from 1998 through, gosh, 2000, really. And I think we must have put out like five or six albums with her in that time, between like live albums and ballad collections and covers collection and various reissues and things like that. So And of course, Mark and Don and Tommy even played with Lana as well. So we all continued to work together, but Rocket Scientist was a little bit on the back burner.
I am the god of hellfire, and I bring you
Prog Watch on Voyage 35 Radio.
And at this point, I'd like to let you hear a little bit of Rocket Scientist's music. The name of this one is Wake Me Up, from their album Brutal Architecture in 1995.
Underwater, I can
Once again, that was Wake Me Up by the Rocket Scientists, featuring Eric Norlander, Mark McCright, and Don Schiff. The name of the album was Brutal Architecture. Now we'll get back into the interview.
And let's see, about halfway through 1999, we had a couple months off. And so we ended up finishing the Oblivion Days album that we had started. And, you know, everyone was kind of spread out and doing different things, and not everyone was available. I'd been working with my friend Greg Ellis, a drummer and a percussionist. He played on my Threshold album, of course. And so I had him come in and do some percussion, and then he did some drum tracks. And, man, I just really liked what he did. I think even Don was out of town or on tour or something like that. So I had my friend Tony Franklin, the fretless bass player.
Really? From The Firm?
Yeah, from The Firm, exactly. Oh, Firm, okay. Blue Murder and all that.
Yeah, yeah, right.
He played on a couple of tracks on that album as well. So that's kind of an eclectic album. It's, you know, it's very much a studio construct. But anyway, we managed to release that in 1999. Then from there, I did my second solo album, Into the Sunset, which was largely done in Europe. And meanwhile, we did Lana's Secrets of Astrology album at the same time. We kind of produced those albums together around the same time. After that, again, we had a little bit of a break. And so Mark and I started doing demos for new Rocket Scientist music. And Don had actually written some things as well. And we worked with a new drummer, a guy named Sean Guerin, who is the son of the famous John Guerin, who is the house drummer in the Merv Griffin band and like kind of a known session player.
Okay.
And we just really loved working with Sean, and we played a couple shows with him, and we were going to go in and record the new record with him. And then Sean ended up taking his own life in,
oh, no.
I'm really bad with dates, but I think it was 2002. So we actually had a really good live recording from one show we did. And Mark had written a song called Better View, which is just a beautiful song. And we had done that at this one concert that we played with a great live recording. Well, it starts off with just kind of acoustic guitar and vocal, and it ends that way. But there's this whole big middle section where I did this big sequence thing with the modular Moog synthesizer. And so Sean had to play to a click in order to sync up with the synth. What we ended up doing on the album when we finally made that is we used Sean's live drums for the middle section because we could sync them up, you know, to the studio track. So he appears on the fourth album, Revolution Road, on that song, Better View, posthumously.
Wow.
And we actually got Simon Phillips to come in and play on the beginning and end, which, of course, you know, we couldn't use that because it wasn't done to a click or anything. But Sean knew Simon, and, of course, you know, Simon knew Sean and his dad. And so it was kind of like I don't want to say a reverse tribute because it was a tribute to Sean, but it was like, imagine, you know, having one of your heroes finish your track for you. That was kind of like the idea. So that's a neat story about that song. And that's my favorite song on the Revolution Road album. So yeah, you have obviously Simon Phillips starting and finishing, and then you have Sean Guerin playing in the middle. So
yeah.
And at this point I figured I'd let you hear a little bit of that song that Eric was talking about. The title, Better View, from the album Revolution Road by the Rocket Scientists in the year 2006.
Behind the saddest eyes, one thing is always true. It's really not so hard as it may seem. The silent prayer I made but never said to you, may it find the way into your dreams. That someday you will fly up where skies are blue, but you
you.
Once again, the name of that one was Better View by the Rocket Scientists from their album Revolution Road, released in 2000.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Six. I'll get back into the interview a little bit.
And, you know, that song is kind of a great summary of what the band is about. Mark McCright is obviously a great songwriter, and he's a great guitar player, but he's not like certainly not a shredder, and he's not like, I don't want to make this sound like it's minimizing him, because it's not, he's not really a lead guitar player. He plays great solos, he writes great solos and all that, but he's not like, you know, the kind of guy that will go to the front of the stage, put one foot up on the monitor and play like, you know, this Guitar Hero solo. You know, his playing is a lot more like, you know, George Harrison, Justin Hayward.
I was going to say, you know, I hear even in some of his vocal melodies, you know, that Mark definitely went to school on the Beatles. And, you know, he's very much about melody. And that's also how I see him. His guitar playing seems to be. I imagine he probably thinks it out and really constructs it. It's not just like doesn't seem like he's a jammer, but will come up with something really nice, you know, and work it out ahead of time and play it the same way every time, more or less, you know, with very little variation, but it's great for what it is, you know, and it fits exactly what it should be. And it's full of melody.
Absolutely. And not only melody, but harmony. Mark's sense of harmony in the way he approaches chords and chord progressions is extremely advanced. And when you hear Mark, you know, just sitting on the couch, strumming an acoustic guitar and singing, just kind of what he does with his chord progressions and, like, you know, the leading melodies in the chords and the line progressions and, you know, just the various implied harmonies, that's where the depth of the guy really comes out. And that song, Better View, is a great example, because it starts off with just Mark strumming guitar and singing, and then it turns into like this big, like Rocket Scientist orchestrated arrangement with, you know, modular Moog synthesizer and stick bass and, you know, frantic drums and all that. And then at the end, it kind of drops back down to like there's Mark like strumming the guitar and singing again. And that's a really great representation of what the band is about.
You've been hitting on a lot of the stuff I wanted to talk about. And that's good. I did want to back you up a little and ask, is Lana Lane like an old high school friend too? I mean, how did you meet her? And were you both musicians when you met? Did you meet through music, you know, or did she get into music because she met you? Or yeah, can you fill us in a little on that?
Sure. I met Lana in 1987 in Sherman Oaks, California, which is a LA suburb. She had a band with two other girls, and it was called Trey Max. They were sort of like, let me make some really dated pop references. If you can think of a cross between like Wilson Phillips and Manhattan Transfer, that was kind of like what they were about. It was like this kind of pop thing, but it had like kind of jazz really overtones. Nice. And each of the girls had their own personality. One of them was like kind of the Madonna pop singer. One of them was like the Streisand Broadway singer. And Lana was like the Ann Wilson rock singer. And they had a backing band with four guys. And the keyboard player had left. And so they needed a new keyboard player. And the band was pretty cool. The guitar player was Larry Wilkins, who was the guitarist in Sugarloaf. Remember, wow, like Green-Eyed Lady?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was Larry. The drummer was a guy named Steve Klong, who was kind of a Terry Bozzio kind of drummer. Unfortunately, both Larry and Steve are no longer with us. They both passed away a few years ago. And the bass player was Dave Maros from Spock's Beer.
Yeah.
So I met Lana and, you know, she played me the stuff they were doing, and I came down and rehearsed with them and did some shows. And And we just really hit it off. And not only did we hit it off personally, but also musically. And I convinced her to quit the band. So I was the Yoko figure. I said, look, you need to be doing rock music. You don't want to do this like pop crap that you're doing. You need to be, out there, and you need to be the singer, not a singer. And so, we started writing songs and demoing songs and doing all that. And then we got married in, 1990. And then we put out our first record in 95. The rest is kind of history. We celebrated our 25th wedding anniversary last year.
That's great. There ain't
so
many people.
How it all just rolls on.
The couple that jams together, stays
That's
together,
right.
I guess. Well, my wife isn't into any of this stuff, but we celebrated 25 also the year before you. So yeah, it's rare these days to hear people that have been together that long. It seems to be we're a dying breed.
That's right. Well, I don't know. Let's see. Mark McCrae, he got married shortly after I did. So they're probably coming up on 25 years. And Don Schiff's been married for longer than that. So
longer than that.
We're very stable.
That's good.
We've got a lot
of,
yes.
Sorry, ladies. They're all taken.
Right.
Voyage 35 Radio. Modern progressive rock tunes.
And I figured while we're doing a special on Eric Norlander, we ought to also include some of his work with his wife, the lovely Lana Lane. On this cut, I believe Eric told me that Mark McCrite and Don Schiff both also played. It's from Lana Lane's solo album El Dorado Hotel, which was released in 2014. And the name of the song is In Exile.
It's gonna be a long
Once again, that was Eric working with his wife, Lana Lane. And he had his rocket scientist cohorts, Mark McCrite and Don Schiff, along for the ride on that one. The name of the song was In Exile. It was from Lana Lane's El Dorado Hotel album, released in 2014. And now I'm going to go ahead and finish up the interview.
In our emails, you mentioned that you are currently working on a new album.
I am, yeah. In fact, I'm going down to Los Angeles tomorrow to shoot some videos for it. We've actually shot some video already. The whole album is in the can. I've just got to take it to the mastering studio sometime here soon. And I think everyone's really going to like it. I don't want to give too much away. It's the follow-up to the Galactic Collective, you know, the album released a few years ago. And so it's this, you know, similar style of music, keyboard-oriented prog rock, and it's actual rock. You know, there's guitars and, you know, rock drums and all that. And it's mostly instrumental, but there's one song on it that Lana sings that I'm really happy with. So I hope you and I can do another appearance, and we could talk about that in a couple months once that's coming out.
So nothing's ready for a preview yet?
No.
Oh, okay. I was hoping to get a world exclusive.
You know what? I played something for you on my keyboard here, but I packed it up for my session that I'm taking down. So I don't even have a keyboard here I could play for you. My piano is way in the back of the room there.
I see all your gear. So you're a big hardware guy, like actual the old dinosaur synths and stuff like that, or do you use any of the digital stuff, the you know, computerized, you know, plugins and whatnot?
I use everything. I love hardware synths. I love software synths. I'm not like a purist. Like it's like, oh, it has to be analog hardware. It's like, if it sounds good, man, I'm in. Count me in.
Yeah.
Anyway, I happen to think that the Hammond organ and the Mini Moog and the Modular Moog and the Mellotron, I happen to think those are just classic, timeless instruments, much like the Les Paul guitar and the Stratocaster and, you know, the Stradivarius violin. And they're just classic instruments that have a sound that you can't really match with other instruments. So it's not that I'm all hung up on playing vintage stuff. I just want to play great stuff. And maybe with keyboards, because first of all, they're huge and they're heavy and they, you know, break down and all that.
Right.
People get kind of pigeonholed into like being like, you know, vintage fanatics and all that. But yet, like guitar players, you know, if you're Gary Moore and you're playing like this 60s Les Paul, no one thinks that you're into playing vintage guitars. They just think you're into playing awesome guitars. So, you know, I'm not like a historian or a collector. I guess I'm a collector by default, because I've got just a ton of keyboards.
Do you have an actual Mellotron? Do you still have an actual Mellotron?
I do have a Mellotron. It's packed up right now. I could show you that too.
Yeah. I'm a Mellotron freak. I love it. You know, I love that instrument.
My Mellotron actually has a walnut case. You know, normally the 400 is white, and my 400 is actually walnut. It matches my Hammond and Mini Moogs. But so I refer to it as the Walnutron.
Cool.
Yes, the Walnutron.
I have a little plug-in for my little setup that is based on the 400. There's some just awesome classic sounds in that.
Yeah.
Just the presets, you know, they've got one, it's called like, I forget, they have clever names that tells you like, it's the end of Entangled. You know what right. I mean? It's the same sound basically that Tony Banks was using at the end of that, you know, with the choir and the strings combined kind of thing. And they have like some, there's like Crimson Elf is another preset that sounds like it's off of like the Wake of Poseidon or something like that. You know, it's.
Yeah. I think that stuff is great. And I've done, you know, a lot of sound design, and I've created sample libraries, and I've done digital synth programming, you know, and that stuff is great too. And I think ultimately, you know, the music is what's important. You know, I love the Mini Moog. I love the grand piano and the Hammond organ and the Mellotron. But, you know, if all I had was, you know, a computer and a MIDI controller, man, I could still make a great album. You know, it's not about the gear. Or there's an expression that I always use with Don Schiff, because Don is a guy, he, you know, plays a million different instruments, and he's got, you know, not only the Chapman stick, he's got five different kinds of Chapman sticks. And we always use the expression, it ain't the fiddle, it's the fiddler.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, it would be great to play, you know, all of my piano tracks on a, you know, on a 9-foot Fazioli grand piano or a Steinway Model D or something like that. But, you know, sometimes I'll do it on a, you know, digital keyboard, because that's all I have available. Or certainly when I tour, I've been able to use a grand piano at some shows, but I mean, man, 99 out of 100, it's, you know, you've got a couple of digital keyboards up there, and that's what you got to do. And I don't let that stop me or impair me, or I don't even think of it as anything less. It's like, it's just different instruments. So I think it's important to always keep the music first, and, you know, not to fetishize the instruments too much.
Yeah. It's a good term.
And, you know, if this room was, had all, you know, most of the gear in it, like it usually does, you would laugh at me for saying that, because I'd be standing, I'd be sitting here in front of, you know, 20 classic 60s and 70s keyboards.
I've seen some of those photos of you on you know, the Google, you know, what is it? Google Images. You know, you look up Eric Norlander, there's some pictures of you just standing with, you know, insane amount of keyboards around you. I think there was one where your dog was in it. You're sitting in an armchair and there's all these keyboards all around you. That's awesome.
That's right. I was taken right around the corner here. That was Zoe. Zoe is not around anymore, unfortunately, but she had 16 really good years. So
that's pretty good for a dog.
But yeah, that was a cool shot.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you mentioned you'd come back, you know, when the new album's out, you know, do you want to do that?
Yes.
That'd be great. I would love to do it. It's been great to talk to you. And, you know, so I don't want to like talk about everything then, you know, we'll leave some stuff for next time. I have plenty of good material here.
So I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. Getting to talk to Eric was a real cool thing. As some of you longtime listeners know, Dave and I featured Eric and some rocket scientists way back when the show was in the first season. So we're big Eric Norlander fans here. And I hope I made a fan out of some of you guys too. If you did like what you heard, whether it be Eric Norlander solo, rocket scientists, or even Lana Lane, you can find more and find product on the website, thetank.com. That's where you can find all things Eric Norlander. Before I wrap up, I'd like to leave you with one more from the Rocket Scientists. The name of this one is The Fading Light. It's from their latest album, Refuel, which was released in 2014.
Lost, you hold on to the fading light.
And once again, that was The Fading Light by the Rocket Scientists from their album Refuel, released in 2014. So as always, I'll ask you, if you like the show, please go like my Facebook page, Prog-Watch on Facebook, or follow me at ProgSquatch, all one word, ProgSquatch, on Twitter. And as always, if you have questions, comments, suggestions, send them along to ProgSquatch, again, all one word, ProgSquatch, at gmail.com. And if you like the show and you're looking for previous episodes, you can find a lot of the episodes at progwatch.com. That's all one word, ProgWatch, no hyphen, .com. Season 1 is complete. Season 2 under construction. Season 3, I'm trying to keep current, and I'm going to be working with my friend Dan Foytik, whom I've mentioned before, is a bit of a web guru and a host of several cool podcasts about horror and other subjects on our home network, Society 13. But at this point, I'd like to say once again, thanks for coming along for the ride, and prog on, brothers and sisters.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.